You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Saying Jerry Bruckheimer's name immediately evokes Hollywood. The legendary producer has spent four decades working in film and television, giving us everything from Top Gun and Beverly Hills Cop to Black Hawk Down and the Pirates of Caribbean series. His movies have helped make superstars of Johnny Depp, Tom Cruise, Nicolas Cage, Richard Gere, Eddie Murphy, Will Smith, and Denzel Washington. And he's also nurtured the careers of directors like Michael Bay, Gore Verbinski, Paul Schrader, Michael Mann, and the late Tony Scott. Now his productive career is being celebrated with a blockbuster of a book for Disney Editions called Jerry Bruckheimer, When Lightning Strikes, Four Decades of Filmmaking. I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. Thank you so much for having me.
And in your introduction, you write that you never imagined there would be a book about you because you never thought you'd be a producer. Then you go on to say, but all I ever wanted to do was make movies.
Yeah, I started as a young kid when I was 6 and 7 years old. My mom would drop me off at the theater, local theater, for a matinee. And, you know, I loved it. I loved that magic on the screen, the exciting actors and adventure. And I wanted to be part of the magic. It was something that I never dreamt I could be part of because I was a kid from Detroit, not from Hollywood or New York, and didn't have the financial means to make that trip across the country.
Well, what did making movies mean to you then? Had you wanted to be a director? Did you want to be an actor?
You know, I'd love to do either one of those things.
Because nobody says I want to grow up and become a producer.
No, but you got to find what you're good at. And I wasn't going to be an actor. That's not something I'd be good at. And a director, I don't have the patience that you have to have. But as far as producing, I was always the kid who could put together the hockey team or the baseball team and organize it and get things going and convince people to do things and get them out to play early in the morning. So that is something that kind of led me to being a producer.
Is that what a movie producer does? Because at the beginning of movies these days, we get 25 different names, and then at the end maybe 30 names, all given some kind of producer credit.
Well, producers do different things, but the type of producer I am, I'm kind of the analogies with a sports team. You know what the manager does. He hires the coach. He hires the players. He wants them to win, but he doesn't own the team. The team is owned by the owners. And in my case, the team is either owned by Disney or Paramount or Warner Brothers or any of the big studios.
You recently left Disney and went back to Paramount after 30 years or so. Has Hollywood changed a lot? Is it the same Paramount you left?
Paramount's always been a great place to work. It's got a phenomenal culture. The people who are running it now are great at what they do. They have enormous success. And hopefully I can add to that success. Has it changed? Absolutely. You can watch content anywhere you want. You can watch it on your iPhone, your iPad. You can watch it on television, go to the movie theaters. So it's changed enormously. There's so many more choices now. With cable, you have HBO, and you have Showtime, and you have all the different venues that you can watch films in.
And the movie attendance is down in the theaters. Prices are going up. I suspect there's a certain connection there, but there are also all of those other options, as you say. Do you imagine that there'll be very many movie theaters in the near future?
I think there'll be a lot. I mean,
still.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you look at China, you look at Russia, they're expanding. There's so many more theaters going in. And the reason the attendance is down, it's about the movies. We haven't made movies this year or past years that have caught the imagination of a large audience. And if we make really good movies, they're going to line up like they did in the past.
How do all of those choices affect the way movies are made? For example, just simple framing. We don't see CinemaScope anymore.
Well, I think we do it pretty much the same way because we can digitally change the frame once it's finished. But we film it usually for the big screen, and then we make adjustments when we put it on the small screen.
Pat Sanson, who heads your post-production department as associate producer on your films, is quoted as saying, "Jerry has a particular genius for finding a film's voice." What does that mean?
Well, it's sort of what is the context of the film? What are we trying to get the audience to understand or draw them into? It's sometimes an actor. It's sometimes the theme of the movie. It can be a thousand things.
Well, the Washington Post once referred to your instincts as you're having a golden gut, but despite all the hits, I suspect there have been a fair number of flops. Do you have any idea of why they become flops? Do you think they're all going to be hits?
I all think they're all going to be flops. I never think they're going to be hits. I always expect the worst and hope for the best. But I think, you know, the movies that don't work for an audience doesn't mean they're not good movies. They just don't work for an audience. You'll learn a lot more from those than you do from the hits.
Well, for as a moviegoer, sometimes I'm watching a film and wondering, what were they thinking? Didn't they realize that this was a disaster from the start?
You don't. If you did, we certainly would change it. You get an indication when you preview it, but it's not always honest. I've had pictures that have previewed through the roof and nobody showed up. So, you know, the audience enjoyed the movie, but we just couldn't get them in to see it.
How intimately are you involved in decisions on the projects you're working on? Do you read every script? Do you watch every cut of every episode of, let's say, CSI or one of the other TV series that you do?
For CSI, for all our TV, I watch every episode and read every script. I work out in the morning and get on the treadmill and 45 minutes on the treadmill, 42 minutes for a CSI episode. Takes me about 40 minutes.
You don't have to watch the commercials.
No, it takes me about 40 minutes to read a script. So I read everything.
And is it a temptation to micromanage?
No, not for television. We have such wonderful showrunners and people in my company, Jonathan Lippman, Christiane Reed, who run television, and they're just excellent at what they do.
You mentioned going to the movies when you were a kid. I remember going sometimes to see triple features, which I can't imagine sitting through today. What kind of movies did you grow up seeing?
You know, I saw the big adventure movies. You know, The Great Escape was one of my favorite movies. I loved David Lean. I loved the characters in David Lean, the scope of his productions.
Even when you were a kid?
Even when I was a kid. When I used to go to the Mercury Theater in Detroit, which was on 7 Mile Road, and that was my temple. I loved going there and couldn't wait to go again.
What did your parents do for a living?
My dad was a salesman. He worked his whole life. He sold clothes. He sold just about everything. And my mom was a housewife.
And when you were thinking about what kind of career to pursue, what kind of advice did they give you?
They said, you know, that of course they wanted to be a doctor or a lawyer. It's ingrained in them to do that. I sort of studied, was going to go for dentistry until I hit organic chemistry and said, that's not for me. I could never get through this because I wasn't a great student. But my cousin told me, he said, do something that you love doing. Don't do something that you have to take a vacation. My dad said the same thing.
But you wound up in advertising. Is that what you love doing?
It was my entry into filmmaking. It was it. Again, I couldn't leave Detroit. Didn't have the financial means to leave Detroit. Worked in a mailroom for a big advertising agency. Got promoted to the television department because I used to do favors for the woman who ran the department. Ann ran the department. I'd pick up her laundry. I'd do stuff that she couldn't do because she was working so hard. And so when she needed somebody to come into her department, she said, this is a perfect, he works really hard. He, you know, he'll do what he's asked to do.
Well, we have a lot of directors who started off making commercials. And in fact, you used Ridley Scott before he started making movies. But that doesn't always, knowing how to make a good commercial doesn't always guarantee that you know how to make a good movie.
No, but you know, it's film. It's not radio. You watch it. And you want somebody who has a visual style that's unique and different, and that's what a lot of these commercial directors have. Michael Bay was a commercial director. Tony Scott was a commercial director. Gore Verbinski did commercials. They have a unique visual style, which I look for. As far as the storytelling goes, and that maybe they're lacking in storytelling, not really, because they're smart individuals, and that's why you hire great screenwriters to work with them, to you know, hone those skills, and they pick it up pretty quickly.
Although often, as we have seen in the past, the director gets all the credit, the screenwriter doesn't.
That happens, unfortunately, but it is usually a team. Unfortunately, we use sometimes a lot of writers on projects because writers get very busy, and they'll finish your project now be four more movies waiting for them to write.
And then a director looks at a script and says, this is not what I want to work with, and brings in his friend or does it himself. And at the end, you have 300 different writers listed suggesting the story, writing some of the script, whatever.
It happens. We try to stop it. We were working on a picture, and we just had hired the director, and he had a meeting with the writer, and on his way home. He was calling another writer to put him on the movie, and we stopped it. We said, no, this is our writer. He wrote the script that you liked, that the studio committed to, and we're going to stick with him.
My guest is Jerry Bruckheimer. We're talking about a book called Jerry Bruckheimer, When Lightning Strikes, Four Decades of Filmmaking. It's published by Disney Editions, has a foreword by Johnny Depp, and it's written by Michael Singer. And it's a huge format book, lots of fabulous photographs. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Jerry Bruckheimer, subject of Jerry Bruckheimer, When Lightning Strikes, Four Decades of Filmmaking, published by Disney Editions, with a foreword by Johnny Depp, somebody he has worked with quite a bit. It's also written by Michael Singer and has, as I said, lots of huge, large format photographs, some of them by you.
Yeah, I took a number of the pictures. I have a camera on the set all the time, so I, you know, take as many pictures as I possibly can.
Do you take them as part of the work, or just because you like to take pictures of things that are happening that relate to your life?
That's exactly it. I love taking photographs. It has nothing to do with the work at all. When I was 6 years old, my uncle handed me his hand-me-down camera because he bought a new one, and I've been taking pictures ever since.
I'd imagine that as a producer, much of your job is thinking out all the possibilities, and that surprises would be your worst nightmare. And yet the subtitle of this book is When Lightning Strikes. What have been some of the worst surprises over the years?
You know, every time you're making a movie, there's something that goes wrong. You can't, you know, you just can't avoid it. We were making Black Hawk Down, and we couldn't get the Black Hawk helicopters. The government wouldn't release them. We had to try to figure out a way to make the movie called Black Hawk Down to have Black Hawk helicopters. But
that's despite the fact that you'd done Top Gun and had so much success with the military?
It was more about getting him into Morocco than it was the military giving him to us. And eventually we got the approval of the Moroccan government and brought him at the very last second.
Well, you could have just painted some other helicopters black, couldn't you?
Well, unfortunately, they have a very distinctive shape.
What was your first film?
It was called The Culpeper Cattle Company, which was a small Western that we made in Mexico for $1 million for 20th Century Fox.
You were living in New York at the time that you moved to Hollywood?
I was living in New York and then moved to Hollywood, exactly right.
Nowadays, you could have stayed in New York because so many movies and TV shows are being shot in Brooklyn and Queens.
I know. We shot one of our shows here, too. So, you know,
we
love it here. It was called Hostage.
It's almost impossible now to think of anyone but Johnny Depp in the role of Captain Jack Sparrow, but he writes in his foreword that executives at Disney were less than pleased with his portrayal. They said things like, is he drunk? Is he gay? Why does he have to walk like that? How close was he to being fired?
Unfortunately, it was exactly as you say it. They were very frightened by his performance. But, you know, what I did is I took one of the scenes that was an excellent scene and cut it together, and Johnny modulated his performance, and we took some of the milder takes and put it in, and they were very pleased when they saw how funny the character was.
Well, he was playing it rather broadly, but before that he had made mostly art house type films and he didn't act that way. Was it because of the way he saw this character?
That's the reason we hired him, because you're making a movie about a theme park ride. And you want to put somebody in that says, this is different. You have an actor who's a skilled actor, doesn't do big commercial movies, and you want his point of view of how he's going to... He created that character. It wasn't on the page.
How often do you have to fight those kinds of battles?
I think I'm just about in every movie. There's something that the people who sign the checks are not exactly pleased with, and you try to overcome them, whether the director's spending too much money, they don't like performance, they want to switch actors... there's so many things that can go wrong when you're making a film.
Do you tempt that to some degree? Because as I see it, you like to cast against type. As when you chose Eddie Murphy to play a Detroit cop in Beverly Hills, or the comic rapper Will Smith and comedian Martin Lawrence for Bad Boys.
I like to, you know, change it up a little bit. I think you have to have something special in you and unique for the audience to grapple onto to get them into the theater. And when you see combinations that you normally wouldn't think would go together, I think it intrigues an audience to show up.
Because the other way is kind of predictable. In the old days, you knew George Raft was going to play a criminal.
Exactly right.
So typecasting is a problem still in Hollywood, isn't it?
Well, sure, because your studios are always looking for a guarantee. There really is no guarantees. But if you get a big movie star, you know it's going to open Friday night and carry over to Saturday. But I worry about the next weekend. That's when you tell if the movie's really working.
Do you like to cast directors against type as well?
Yes and no. I mean, certain directors, it's when
some people do action better than others. Some do comedy better than others.
But you know what? It's always about a good storyteller. We can always find people to do the action. That's not difficult. You want a great storyteller.
My staff points out that one of the great casting against type incidents was Henry Fonda in Once Upon a Time in the West, where he plays a villain. We just so used to seeing Henry Fonda as the good guy.
That's really smart. I think that was good for his career, and it was also good for an audience to see him playing a role that he normally doesn't.
Now, do you try to find people you think will be good directors? How did you team up with the late Don Simpson?
Don was my partner for many years. He was a roommate of mine when I was first came to Hollywood, and he was a brilliant man. He ran production at Paramount. He was a great storyteller. Very vivacious, intelligent, from Alaska, had a whole different point of view, but very similar to mine, and I was very lucky to have him as a partner for 13 years.
Do you remember saying back in 1987 that our movies are representative of the way that we feel? It's our way of trying to rearrange reality. Our movies are representative of the way we'd like to see life go. It'd be nice if life would go like our movies. It doesn't, it can't, but at least for 2 hours it can. Do you still subscribe to that philosophy?
Absolutely. We want completion on our movies, hopefully a good completion. And it's much better when you have an audience that walks out of the theater feeling that they really experienced something and they feel better for it. And also, we took them away from their life for a couple hours.
When you are thinking of a TV project, do you think in the same way that you do with a film?
Yeah, it's really about what I want to see. I don't know what you want to see. I don't know what an audience wants to see, but I know what I like.
So you want to see both CSI and The Amazing Race?
I love them both. They've been both on television for a long time. CSI is going to go into its 15th season. It's tying ER, so that's pretty exciting.
We had isn't CSI the wasn't originally created by a guy who was a parking valet in Las Vegas?
Tram operator.
Yeah, he was on our show many years ago, and he thanked you for recognizing that he had a good idea when everybody else was turning it down.
I think everybody turned it down. Yeah. I mean, CBS fortunately bought it in the room, and it's been on the air for going into 15 years now.
What's important to keep in mind when you're creating a spinoff?
To keep the same energy and excellence that you do in the original.
But that doesn't always happen. The original is out there. It's a big success. And then the spinoff comes along and it feels like a watered-down version of the original.
Not if you have great actors. That's the trick.
Well, television now, you can get better actors than you could have in the past because in the old days, if you wanted a career in movies, you try to steer clear of anything but a guest appearance on television.
It's all changed because there's so much good television. Actors want to play those characters because you have 22 weeks to develop a character. In a movie, you've got 2 hours, and plot always wins out over character.
How often are producers immortalized in the cement outside of Grauman's Chinese Theater?
I wouldn't know, but unfortunately, I'm one of them.
4 years ago, and everybody you knew showed up?
It was a good day for me.
So you say that you prefer actually to go to small theaters, not large ones like Grauman's, with your wife. You don't want to go to the big premieres?
I much prefer seeing it with a real audience, not a Hollywood audience. They're tainted and react to their friends rather than the entertainment of the movie.
I have been to some of the prior screenings where people applauded what I thought was an absolute bomb.
Right.
And you knew that they were the related to the gaffer and to some of the other people who had worked on the film.
That's why I go to the mall to watch movies.
Because the audiences are more honest?
They're the real. They paid money. The people in a Hollywood screening don't pay money to see it.
Do you rewatch your old films?
No, never, because I want to change them. And I can't. They're done.
Well, you don't have final edit.
I do.
You do?
Well, sometimes I share it with the director, and sometimes I have final cut.
Now, you go to the films with your wife, usually,
yes.
Linda,
yes.
An oddity in Hollywood. You married 38 years?
You know, we've been together for 38 years, married for 21, so it's pretty good.
And the question that I always feel a little comfortable asking, because people, when people ask me, who was your favorite guest ever, I can't answer. But do you have certain movies that you are particularly proud of?
All of them. They're all your kids. You don't favor one over the other. Everyone's been an amazing experience. Some of them haven't been huge successes, but it doesn't mean they're not good movies. And the fun making them was the joy, the apple on the sundae.
And do you still have as much fun now as you did when you started?
Even more fun. It's because you're working with old friends a lot of times, and it's great to come back to great people you've worked with in the past.
Well, how do you judge success? Is it that the film turned out to be the one you wanted to do, or the one that made millions and millions of dollars?
I think it's a combination of both, and when you hit a home run, you get both.
Well, you have 19 films that exceeded the $100 million mark in box office receipts. Your television programs have gotten a ton of every kind of award. Emmys, you've won Grammys, you've won Golden Globes, People's Choice, BAFTA, MTV. And it's still fun?
It's a blast. It's creative. It's fun. You're entertaining people. My greatest joy is standing in the back of the theater and watching people applaud, cry, and laugh at what we created.
So before you go, what's in the works? Is there a movie that you think everybody's going to be going to see?
Well, we're working on another Pirates. That's a good one. We're going to make another Beverly Hills Cop with Eddie Murphy, so we're excited about that. There's a whole bunch of other things that we're working on.
Jerry Bruckheimer, When Lightning Strikes, Four Decades of Filmmaking. It's published by Disney Editions with a foreword by Johnny Depp. It's written by Michael Singer, and it has been my great pleasure to speak with its subject, Jerry Bruckheimer himself, on our show today. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.